Thank you very much for inviting me. It's exciting. I think I haven't given a share here in probably about 7 years. I think 6 or 7 years. But it is a privilege, and especially seeing Kobe again. Kobe used to learn with us in our Beis Medrash back in the day. And thank you for inviting me. Jews are known for asking questions, for answering a question with a question, right? Abraham, our first monotheist, asks questions of Hashem, the most famous one being, of course, with stone, also related to our descent to Mitzrayim. And I brought you source number one on the sheet, just I found this fascinating. Isidore I. Rabi, Nobel laureate in physics, passed away, as you see there, in 1988. This is from a letter to the New York Times by another scientist named Donald Sheff. So, Isidore Rabi was once asked, why did you become a scientist rather than a doctor, a lawyer, or a businessman like the other immigrant kids in your neighborhood? He was, in fact, his family were immigrants. They moved into, as you see, you don't see on here, but they moved into New York, I think in Brooklyn. So his answer has served as an inspiration for me as an educator, as a credo for my son during his schooling, and should be framed on the walls of all the pedagogues, power brokers, and politicians who purport to run our society. The question was posed to Dr. Rabi by his friend and mine, Arthur Sackler, himself a multi-talented genius who sadly also passed away recently. Dr. Rabi's answer, as reported by Dr. Sackler, was profound. My mother made me a scientist without ever intending it. Every other Jewish mother in Brooklyn, there's your answer, Brooklyn, would ask her child after school, so, did you learn anything today? But not my mother. She always asked me a different question. Izzy, she would say, did you ask a good question today? That difference, asking good questions, made me become a scientist. I thought that was a really beautiful point that he made. And the connection between Isidore Rabi and Judaism goes deeper than this story and is a topic for some other time. But the question that I have, building off of the propensity of Jews to ask questions and to value questions, is why do we value questions in Judaism, and in particular when it comes to the Seder night, where questions appear all over the Haggadah? Obviously, Manishtana is a focal point for it. We ask questions about matzah, maror, dipping, leaning, questions which go back to the Beis HaMikdash, right? This is our original Seder material, was asking questions. The questions asked by the Arbabanim. I brought you on the sheet, if you take a look at source number two, just because I find that not everybody recognizes where the Arbabanim come from. The fact that these four questions, or three questions plus one, right, associated with the four kids at the Seder are actually not, you know, something that somebody made up at some point, but they're actually straight out of the Chumash. So if you just take a fast look at the four bullet points, you've got it in Hebrew and in English. The first one, Ki yishalcha bincha machar le'mor moha edoz ha'chukim v'mishpatim asher tzivah Hashem Elokeinu Hashem. This one from Parshas Veschanan. When your son asks you, what are the edoz chukim mishpatim, which I randomly translated as testimony, statutes, and laws, you can feel free to shuffle them, that's okay. That's the question that we associate with which child? Uh-oh. Got to practice on the Haggadah. You can try again. Sorry? The Chukim HaShbatim is which kid? The Chacham, right. This is the question of the Chacham. You are excused for thinking it might be the Rasha, because he says Eschem at the end, and that's the source of some debate, why we call the Rasha bad for saying Lachem, and he says Eschem. Is there a distinction? Lachem, Eschem. That's the Chacham's question, to which the answer, by the way, is not in the Chumash, that we don't eat anything after the Afikomen, right? The answer in the Chumash, bonus points if you know this, is Avadim Hayinu Lefaro V'Mitzrayim. It's not the Afikomen answer. The Haggadah says, Af ata emor lo kilchos ha-pesach, also you should say, according to Hilchos ha-pesach, but the Haggadah, called the Seder Ha'aruch, says it's also in addition to the answer that's there in the Chumash. But that's your first question, is right there from Parshas Veschanan. And then you have your second question. Your kids are going to say to you, what is this service for you? That's the Rasha's question, to which the answer is not put his teeth on edge, but rather v'amartem zevach pesach hu la'Hashem, and the Kli Yakar says, yeah, the answer of hakeyas shina, of put his teeth on edge, is, again, if this answer doesn't work. you say to him, Zevach Pesach, this is our carbon for Hashem because of what Hashem did in Egypt, and if he looks at you and says, yeah, but so what? Then it's time to put his teeth on edge. They didn't say to him, well, you wouldn't have gotten out, so there. But that's the Rasha. And then the third one, when your child asks you mazos, that is the tum, right? The simple question, what is this? And then the last one is vikadatalavincha. It just says tell the kid. It doesn't say the kid is going to ask, and that's eno de'elishol. In fact, the child did not ask. It was simply you're supposed to articulate it. So the Torah itself presents the Seder format as questions and answers. Not just that. There are things we do at the Seder in order to inspire questions, to push questions. What are some of the things we do at the Seder that are meant to inspire questions? Right, dipping in, well, it depends. Different people dip in different things. We have salt water for some. We have vinegar for others, perhaps. But salt water, I think, is the common one. So if you take a look at, where did I bring it on here? It is number 6. The Gemara in Pesachim says, Ba'inan trei tibuli. We dip twice. Why do we dip twice at the Seder? Ki hechi de lehevi behekera latino goes. So that the kids will understand, hey, something strange is going on here. So indeed, that's why we dip twice. What else do we do with the Seder to inspire questions? If you can do it without looking at the source sheet, even better. Chotz and matzos, afikoman grabbing. Quick poll. How many of you grew up in homes where the parents hide the afikoman and the kids have to find it? How many of you grew up in homes where the kids steal the afikoman and hide it somewhere and then you have to go look for it as adults? Okay, so we have a few. Okay, I'm not the only one. I sometimes ask that question in a group and I find that I'm the only one who grew up with the kids being the ones to take the afikoman. But in fact, that's right. Taking the afikoman away, I brought it in. Which one? Number 8. Chotz bin matzah v'leilei Pesachim. Rabbi Eliezer says, we grab the matzah on the night of Pesach, b'shvil tinoko shlo yishnu, so the kids will not sleep, but instead, they will be invested in what is going on. For another example, flip back to the first side, please. Source number 3. The Tana Rabbanan, Hakol Chayavin Barba Kosas Halalu. Everybody has to have the 4 cups. Echad Anoshim, Bechad Anoshim, Bechad Tinokos, men, women, children. And Amr Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yehuda said, V'chimato Elas Yeshli Tinokos V'yayin. He says, what good is it to give kids wine? I second the motion. What are you doing? Ela Mechalkin Len Kleos Vegozin, Be'erev Pesach Kadeshalo, Yishnu V'yishalo. We give them toys. We give them candy. Get them hyped up on sugar. Get those kids ready to not fall asleep at the Seder or ever again, and that way they will be able to ask questions at the Seder. Perhaps the most famous example of something that we do at the Seder to encourage questions is taking the Ka'ara away, putting the Ka'ara back, right? Different Haggadahs vary. It's really a lot of fun to give out different Haggadahs at your Seder and watch people get confused as to when you pick up the cup of wine, when you put it down, when you move the matzah away, when you cover the matzah, and so on. If you take a look at source number 4, Shulchan Aruch writes, V'az yitzaveh lahasira me'al ha'shulchan, then you instruct to remove the matzah from the table, l'hanicham besofa shulchan kilu kvar ochlu. Put it at the end of the table as though you've already eaten. This is still in the early going. So the kids see and they ask, what in the world is that? And then Mosgin lo miyad kos sheni, and you pour immediately a second cup of wine before you even had the meal. Again, so the kids will ask questions and want to know, why is it that we are doing this? Just to even out the set, there's one more that I didn't include. And that is washing for karpas. There's a major debate as to why we wash for karpas. Some say we wash for karpas because in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, when we're much more careful about purity and impurity, we wash before produce that has been washed before, that's actually coming up in Sefer Vayikra and the Parsha. And so in order to stick to that, because we're commemorating what was done in Beis HaMikdash, so therefore we also wash for karpas. But that's not the Aruch HaShulchan's position. Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein in source number 7 says, even someone who's not careful all year long to wash before handling, eating produce that has been dipped already in liquid, which can receive tumah, nonetheless, the Pesach itol yadav, do it anyway on Pesach, because we do a lot of things differently that night. So you're washing, in other words, you go to wash, and the kid says to you, why are we washing now? And you say, good question. Now we just move on. You asked a question. The Tosfos actually makes that point that I just made as a joke. And I'm going to go back to the first slide one more time because I think I didn't... Yeah, it's there. Number five. Tosfos there makes the point about the fact that not all of the questions that we're asking at the Seder are actually going to lead to meaningful answers related to the Seder. Right? If the kid asks, why did I wash for Karpas? And the answer is, thank you for asking, now let's turn the page, then what has the kid learned? So Tosfos here makes the comment, umitoch kach, he's talking about moving the table away. As a result of moving the table, yavo lishal b'shar dvar, so I'll ask about other things as well. You can't say, well, he asked about moving the table, now I don't need to ask Manishtana at the Seder anymore. The reason Tos has to say that is because in the Gemara that he's commenting on, they move the stuff away. Abaye asks the question of, hey, why did you move that? And Rava says, great, now we don't need to say Manishtana anymore. So Tos says, not so fast. You don't get out of Magid because the kid asked about moving the table. What must have happened in the story is just not recorded in the Gemara, which is then they moved into a conversation that led to a discussion of Yetzias Mitzrayim. So what you have here is a set of practices, which admittedly I put in the order of the way they appear in the Haggadah, but we went a little bit out of order because we went with, you know, when people answered and said, well, this is what we do, this is what we do. But to put it in order, we give out toys before the Seder, we remove the matzos, the ka'ara, we put them back, we have a second cup of wine before the meal, or at least pour the second cup of wine before the meal, later we have it, we dip twice, we wash for karpas, we grab the afikomen. These are all ways to inspire kids to ask questions, but even stronger, it's actually a requirement of the Seder. The Gemara of Sachem, which I brought you here in source number 9, Chacham b'no shavalo. If the child is wise enough to ask the question, the child asks the question. V'im eino chacham. But if not, if the child just doesn't know, ishto shavalto. So fine, your wife can ask you. This is working with the assumption that the male is the one leading the Seder. I leave it to you to discuss whatever structure you have at your own Seder, but that's the assumption here. And therefore, the wife will ask the question, v'im lav, hu shavala atzmo. And if not, then ask yourself. And even if it's two Talmidei Chachamim sitting together and they know the whole story and they know all the halachos, they still have to ask the questions. Someone's got to ask. It's built into the structure of the Seder, and this is brought by the Rambam in the 7th parak of Hilchos Chametz Matzah. This is brought in the Shulchan Aruch as well as the Aruch HaShulchan. If you take a look at source number 10, Rabbi Chiel Michal Epstein, writing in the very beginning of the 20th century, and his Aruch HaShulchan says, v'mein lo bas, and if there is no, he goes through, the son asking, the daughter asking, he says, if there's no daughter either, tishalanu ishto, let his wife ask, o acher, ayoshev al HaShulchan yishalanu, or someone else at the table should ask, v'pnei da ha-Torah hikpida she'inyan zechiras yitzias mitzrayim ba'layla hazeh tia al yidei she'elo tshuva. The Torah cares, we saw it, we spelled out the four psukim back in source number 2, the Torah cares that the way we tell the story should be, question, answer, question, answer. Ach, imein misha yishal, but what do you do if there's no one to ask? Sholom eishav la'atzmo, sit in front of a mirror. Ask questions to yourself. Ukshiyesh shoel, and if there is someone to ask, ein tzarechu la'agira manishtana, ela matchila barimayinu, that you don't need to say manishtana. Someone already at the table already said manishtana. What's going on? And that's it. There's actually this interesting discussion about whether everyone asks the questions. What do you do at your Seder? Do you have a little kid ask Manishtana and then you just move on? Or does everybody then say Manishtana after the little ones have asked it? Everybody?
Usually the kid's uncomfortable sometimes doing it alone.
Right, the kids don't like doing it alone. They need company. But often that'll be like someone who's sort of older, but not everybody together, right? I always feel like I have to. Of course I have to say it. Like, you know, I'm not willing to just have the kids say Manishtana. But then again, I'm also the one who, when I used to daven in a shul with the Anam Zemiros, when, you know, I would say along with the Chazan line, and then say the Kahal line as well. I've been spared from that for the last 10 years living in Toronto, where most shuls don't say, did they say Anam Zemiros here?
No.
Most shuls here, I think, did not say Anam Zemiros. So I say neither the Chazan line nor the Kahal line. But for Manishtana, the question is, do you need to do it, or can it just be the kid? In fact, the Haggadah Hegyonei Halacha of Rav Yitzchak Mirsky reads that as a debate among the Rishon, among the early authorities. And he believes that he sees in the Rambam's language that the Rambam believes that that everyone has to ask some question. It isn't enough for the child. Take a look at source number 11. That's where I brought it for you on the sheet. He writes, this is, the Rambam is very interesting. Well, the Rambam is interesting in general, but in the seventh parak of Hilchos Chametz Umatzah, the Rambam gives you what you do at a Seder. In the eighth parak, he tells you what they do in the Beis HaMikdash. So this is from his Beis HaMikdash description. The language is different in his regular every year, no Beis HaMikdash, well, regular for now anyway, Seder. But he writes, Umozgin HaKos HaSheni, you pour the second cup, V'kan HaBen Shoel, and here the son asks, V'omer HaKorei Manishtana HaLayla Zimikol HaLaylos, and then whoever's doing the reading says Manishtana. So he has the idea that it's not just the kid, but rather that it's going to have to be done by a leader as well. Others disagree. One more piece of evidence, very interesting question and answer regarding this this issue of the questions. What we're doing here, I should have set out structure in the first place, is first I'm just building the case that you have to do this as question and answer, and then I want to get into the title of the shiur, which is, so why is that? Why is this such a crucial piece? Why does the Torah want me to do that? But in terms of what, you know, just one other piece of evidence of the importance of this, Rav Meshulam David Soloveitchik was asked a very interesting question. A man's children had made aliyah. He was still living wherever he was, outside of Eretz Yisrael. He went to visit them for Pesach. Now, I'm not passing for anybody what they should do if they are in Pesach for Yom Tov Sheni and they're a Ben Chutz Laretz. That's the Rav's job. But what this fellow was doing was he was going to have a second Seder in his children's home with them being aware that he's having a Seder. But for them, it's not Yom Tov. So the question that was asked of Rav Shlomo David Soloveitchik was, what exactly happens at this Seder? Do the kids have to participate so that someone will ask the questions? Or it's not Yom Tov for them. It's Cholmoy. It's not a Seder for them. It's a meal. You know, it's whatever. This year it's Friday night in the Motzei Shabbos. So for them it's Motzei Shabbos. Do they have any Kibbud Avayim element? Like, is there any reason for them to have to stay at the Seder? So take a look at source number 12. From the response in the Haggadah Shaila Torah, which is also known as the Haggadah of Brisk, he says, Eino Kiyum Hanaseh V'ben. He says, the fulfillment of asking the questions isn't about the kid. Granted, the kid has no mitzvah to ask that night. Nonetheless, it's not about him. Elohu chiyuv hamuto al ha'av lekayim es hamitzvah hazu al yedei haben. It is the duty of the parent to fulfill this mitzvah via the child. The child is the object, so to speak, used to fulfill the mitzvah of the parent. Ach hamitzvah kishala atzmei shalav. It's the father's mitzvah. So what he argued was, it's the father's mitzvah, and the children should help the father fulfill his mitzvah, and therefore the children should be present at the Seder, and they should ask the questions. Even though for them it's not Yom Tov questions, it's not Seder questions, it doesn't matter. Having the questions is a built-in necessity for the father's Seder. Again, I'm not discussing the question of practicing a second Seder in front of B'nai Eretz Yisrael, which is a very interesting question in its own right. But the upshot of all of this is that it's so ingrained that our Seder has to be question, answer, and so I want to know why. What is it that we're looking for? The easy answer is, well, the Torah said so. Right? We saw it in source number 2. That was very straightforward. We even have this idea, which I brought you in source number 13, that matzah is called in the Torah lechem oni. The simple explanation, lechem oni, means what? Bread. Poor man's bread of affliction, bread of suffering, right? But the drash that Shmuel brings here is that it's like the word la'anot, meaning to answer. Lechem she'onin alav devarim. Right, so I may add the word harbe, bread upon which we give many answers. That's nice. But that doesn't explain why. Why is it that this is so important? Why are we structuring our Seder this way? Why does Hashem instruct us to use the formula? What would you say before you see the answers that I've got on the sheet? Because that's cheating.
That way they listen.
That way they listen, meaning?
That means why are you getting us to ask questions now, right? Because you know that way we'll get...
This is good pedagogy. Right? This is good pedagogy. People learn much better when there's a question and an answer. Right? I tried it from time to time when I was a shul rav. I would try, like, for the drasha, you know, trying to do that. And generally speaking, there were certain people in the crowd who would make that fall apart because then there was no drasha anymore. I wasn't the one giving the drasha to word better. It's a little bit of a dicey thing. You can do it if you know your crowd. But that's absolutely a good explanation for it. If you take a look at source number 14, Derech HaKudecha, the Rosh Yalem Melech Shapira, also known as the author of the Bnei Yisaschar, I believe, he says, "Hadavar sheba al yedei sheela, ba ha'inyan berov hadvar misudar umatok lachech v'nikba b'yoser b'nefesh." He says, when something comes via a question, you ask something and somebody answered you, so that is something you will be able to learn well. He poetically says, it will be sweet for the palate. Halo tira kama me'amachavram. He says, look at what writers do. Ashayir to l'chavar eze inyan rachav. When they want to write about some very broad topic, u'misyarin pen Yukublu advarm laozen, right? They're worried that people aren't really going to accept or listen to what they're saying. So he says, "Ilozen ha'inyan l'seichel u'l'seichel machmas kotzer amasik ba'omek hamusak baruch baruchav." He says, because the listener is limited, because it's a hard topic. So what do? You do it b'derech shaul meishiv. You do it via question and answer. It helps people to learn. It is good pedagogy. I think I brought you a number 15. Yes, the Dubna Magid says it beautifully. Kmo shelo yarav achila belo ravona kodmo, kein lo serav hatshuva bilti achrei haflagas hasheila. He says, just like food is not sweet unless you are hungry for it beforehand, so too an answer is not really sweet unless it follows a great question. When you ask the question, then, and you're driven to ask the question, that's when the answer works better. So I think that's certainly a good answer. I think it's a functional answer, and it explains a lot. I think we have three more answers that we could offer. Anyone want to throw out another idea?
Can I just say, the Magid's comparison to hunger is very, very telling. In other words, when a person is hungry, they realize they need food.
Right.
When a person asks the question, they realize something, so this is what they need for the answer, as opposed to just hearing his speech.
Right, very good. It certainly does. It's driven by them. It's fundamentally, I want to know. So, a second idea. Sorry, you were going to say?
No.
Okay. You could. A second idea, which I found fascinating, from Rabbi Yitzhak Mirsky in the Haggadah Hegyone Halacha, I brought it here in number 16. He says, Makom shata motze gzera v'shibud ein sham she'elos. He says, when you have slaves, slaves don't get to ask questions, right? The only question is, how often do you want me to do this, right? Jump how high, that type of thing. That's the way it works when someone is a slave. Shein shelem makom sheyesh chirus. To ask questions means that you have a certain element of freedom. The slave, his mouth is sealed. He's not able to ask. So asking questions demonstrates an element of freedom. I thought that was a very interesting insight. It doesn't really expand on it much. It just sort of brings it and moves on. But I think there's something worth thinking about. Yeah?
What's coming to me or bothering me about it is that, in theory, they're good ideas about why people would want to ask questions, but we've structured the Haggadah with the questions. Everything is so forced by which we're already making the simanim that they're going to say, whoa, well, you know, that's out of the ordinary. I'm going to ask that. It seems like there's a limitation to the questions, like, that are implicit in this structure. It's not like true freedom of thought or questioning. Am I making any sense?
You are making perfect sense. What you are pointing to is a classic problem of Judaism.
Yeah.
Ask the
questions, but don't ask the wrong questions.
Well, not so much that, but it's a classic problem of Judaism. In areas going way beyond the Haggadah, and that is that we tend to confuse text for boundary. I'm going to take it in the area of davening. The Rambam famously writes in the beginning of his Hilchos Tefillah, his Laws of Davening, that it used to be that davening was the individual stating to Hashem what their needs were. There are certain ikar, you have to mention, and you talk about what you need. However, you get to the period right before the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, between the two Batei Mikdash, And people lose their facility with Hebrew. People also become a little bit weaker religiously in of itself during this period of Galus, during this period of exile. And the Anshei Knesset HaGedola see a need. The Great Assembly says, if we leave people to their own devices, they're not even going to say the minimum things that they're supposed to say. So what we're going to do is, we're going to create a text. This becomes known as Shmoneh Esrei, as the Amidah, and it's the minimum for people to say. So I can't tell you how many times I have been asked, doesn't the Mishnah in Brachos say that if you make your davening rote, right, if you make your davening fixed, it's not acceptable to Hashem? So how is it that you have a Shmoneh Esrei? And my answer is, because Shmoneh Esrei was never intended to be the sum of your davening. Shmoneh Esrei was the minimum. Here's how you make sure you've said the minimum to God that you're supposed to say. Build on it, though. There are particular places in Shmoneh Esrei. It could be outside of Shmoneh Esrei. It doesn't have to be in Shmoneh Esrei. There are opportunities to engage in what is recognized as tefillah that isn't in the Shmoneh Esrei. But we get it into our head that what started out as a minimum is actually a maximum. So I'm going to say this and nothing further. And so we cheat ourselves of the opportunity because we flipped it. And I think the same thing is true regarding the Haggadah. These questions are all minimum, not maximum. You know, my family does something which my father started doing a few years back, and I really liked it. And, you know, I believe very strongly in the power of minhag, so I preface what I'm going to say by saying that, and therefore don't change minhagim lightly. But for karpas, what do your families use?
Celery.
What kinds of questions do the kids ask when you put out potato, celery, and, you know, whatever, salt water?
They have it every day.
Oh. What? Have more.
They want more?
Yeah.
Okay. So I will tell you this. In my family, we keep usually one of those, like celery or potato or something, out for the purists. And we use banana and pineapple. You say, ew, pineapple and salt water is amazing.
Is it?
Yes. Pineapple and salt water is amazing. Try it. But why? Because the Gemara just says you're dipping something. Plus, it has to have a bar priya dama so that it'll count for the maror as well. That's the limit of your obligation. Advantage, number one, kids ask questions when they see you dip banana and pineapple in salt water. Kids who see parsley, in my experience, maybe your table they want more, maybe potato. Potato I hear, because it's like potato chips. But otherwise, the question that I would get from my kids if I pass down parsley with salt water is, do I have to have that? That's not the question we're looking for. It engages the kids. When you change over to that, plus, they never forget that banana and pineapple are bar priya dama. They're never going to forget it now because they've seen it at their Seder. So there's an advantage to that. My point, though, is not so much that, although if you're not going to do it at the Seder, fine, but try it sometime. Pineapple and salt. Banana and salt water kind of falls apart. Pineapple and salt water does better. So my father started doing it. And actually, I found out, Rav Elazar Prale, I think, from New Jersey, from Fairlawn, New Jersey, part of the Tights. Somehow, Mishpacha, I think he started a few generations ago, but it works, and it's good. But the point is, there's no limit on the things you can introduce in order to get the kids to ask questions. Be creative with it. Don't look at it as a maximum, and I certainly would not say that there are wrong kinds of questions, although the problem you always run into is there's a time limit.
Right.
The kids have to get to bed. People are hungry. So there are things that can be done to deal with that. Shulchan Aruch does not have to be the time when everybody leaves the table to go take a nap, right? It can be a time for discussion of the items that you didn't get to during the Seder. I know people who actually race through Magid in order to turn Shulchan Aruch into a real discussion. They tell me it works nicely. So you want to think about how you structure it. Last year we wanted to do something for our Seder. It didn't work out because of some logistics. We wanted to ditch the dining room table altogether. Go into living room space. Set up pillows and cushions around the room, right? The way that you used to do it back in the old country, not Poland, Yemen. And recline like that. Do a haseba properly, because when you do that, it encourages more discussion, right? It's much more relaxed.
Yeah.
You know? Things like that can really help. You want to build the question element, whether because of the, you know, showing you're no longer an Eved, whether because it's good pedagogically, or for the two reasons that I still have to get to. The, because, you know, it's Seder night, you have to have four things. But definitely do more to encourage the questions. A third approach. And the third and fourth are sort of my own thoughts, but I think that they still have some truth to them. The third one is questions are valuable as skepticism. And what I mean by that is that we're taught that we went down to Mitzrayim and our existence in Mitzrayim because, in some measure, because of skeptical questions. Go back to the Gemara Nedarim. I didn't bring it on the sheet, so I will tell you the Gemara Nedarim. It's Nedarim Lamed Beis. It's based on source number 17. I'm not sure why I didn't put the Psukim on, but I didn't. So I'll just tell it. I mean, you see the reference. But Hashem speaks to Abraham and tells him that his children are going to receive the land. I'm giving your children this land. And Abraham says to Hashem, Bama Eida Ki Irashana, which is not so easy to translate, but roughly it reads, how do I know that I'm getting this land? And at that point, Hashem says to him, take the Aglam Mishulesh and Ez Mishulesh and Ayel Mishulesh, all Brit Bein Abitarim, the covenant between the pieces, and he tells him, know that your children are going to be strangers in a land not their own, they're going to be made to work, and so on. That whole prediction of going down to Mitzrayim, and it's a very odd back and forth. Hashem says, you're getting the land. Abraham says, how do I know? And Hashem says, actually, your kids are going to be slaves, and dot, 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 eventually they're getting back here. What happened? How did that conversation go? Says the Gemara Nedarim. This is one view within the Gemara, that's why we had to go down to Mitzrayim. Because Avram asked that question. Which is really hard for me to grasp, I must admit. Avram is the height of faith, right? Avram and Sarah, Lech Lecha, Akedah, rings a bell. We usually look at Abraham as the height of what one can achieve in terms of human emunah. Nonetheless, it's the Gemara saying it, it's not me saying it, so don't ask me how the Gemara can say it, the Gemara said it. That is one question. Then you get Moshe, right? Moshe shows up at the Sneh, and Hashem says to him, I want you to go to Mitzrayim and save your brethren, who we know Moshe cares about. Moshe killed the Mitzvah in order to save the Jew, right? Moshe cares deeply about them. But what is Moshe's response to Hashem? A whole series of questions, which I referenced for you in number 18. Couldn't you send somebody else, right? That whole dialogue, which the Medrash tells us takes a full week. And then, after that, Moshe goes to Mitzrayim, speaks to Paro. Paro says, double the workload, and Moshe comes back to Hashem. And he says, see, it only made things worse. What are you doing? How could you do this? It's question after question after question. And then, we get out of Mitzrayim. And despite the Makos, despite the plagues, we show up at the sea, and it's, why did you take us out of Mitzrayim just to bury us in the Midbar? Oh, fine, I'll take you through the sea. We go through the sea. Now I don't have water. Right? Why did you take us out of Mitzrayim? Now I don't have food. Why did you take us out of Mitzrayim? Question after question after question, when we are thirsty, when we're hungry, when we're scared. At the Seder, we reenact Yetzias Mitzrayim. We reenact getting out of Egypt. And so, we also ask questions, right? The Rambam says in source number 20, the Chol Dor V'Dor Chayev Adam L'Haros Es Atzmo Ki Lehu Ba'Atzmo Yatza Atam Yishivud Mitzrayim. In every generation, you have to either see yourself or act as though, depending on your edition, you had left Egypt now. So that's what we do. We ask questions as well. We're reenacting Yitzias Mitzrayim, but we do it with a positive spin. Instead of the question of, why do you do this to me, God? It's the questions that lead us to say, wow, Hashem, you did this for me. It's questions that lead to hakaras hatov, to a dayenu, to a recognition of the good that we've received. So it's we're following the original question model, but flipping it to be positive. You follow? So I think that may have some merit to it as an idea. And then a fourth idea. And the fourth idea goes back to the term in English, or one of the terms in English for questioning. What is another word for to question someone?
Interrogate?
Good. I was worried I didn't have to give clues. To interrogate. So interrogate comes from two words in the Latin. Inter, rogare. Inter means between. Rogare, ask. Right? You're asking between. Meaning, to interrogate, to ask a question, is not simply about, I want information, so I'm putting it out there, and someone is going to provide a response. It's a connection between the person who is asking and the person who is answering. It creates, effectively, a bond. Right? What motivates a question is curiosity, yes, there's information that I could use, but also a desire to connect with the person. I brought you in source number 21, the best technique in sales leads telemarketing. You all know this because you've been on the receiving end, even if you've never been on the originating end. Start a conversation. It doesn't have to be a long one or anything. It just has to be easy and social enough to compel your audience to listen to what you say. And mind you, you are not telling them all the details yet. You just aim to get a reaction from them at the start. That's what they mean. That's what they're doing when they ask you, how's your day going? Not only is it not because they care, but it's also, it's a tactic. It's a sales tactic. That's what they're doing because they understand. Asking someone a question is a way to build a connection. It's weird, but that's human psychology for you. Go back in the Chumash. Where's the very first question in the Chumash?
Is it Hashem asking Adam?
Even before that, sorry.
Oh.
Something about a partner, maybe?
Don't know. It's before Hashem asks Adam, where are you? The snake. Right? The snake says to Chava, Af ki amar Elokim lo sochlu mikol eitz hagan, right? They have right? He says to her, didn't God say, lo sochlu, don't eat, mikol eitz hagan, from any tree in the garden? Is that true? No. Hashem didn't say, don't eat from any tree in the garden. So why did Nachash start that way? Why didn't the Nachash start with something true? Didn't God say, don't eat from this tree, and doesn't the fruit look really good? He could have said that. Why did he say something that was false?
Connection.
To start the conversation. It's going to get her to answer. And once there's an answer, there's a connection. That's exactly right. He says something that he knows she knows is false. Similarly, now to go to yours, right? The next question in the Chumash, Hashem says, Ayeka, right? Which, there are a lot of midrashim on the word Ayeka, Eicha, and so on, but the simple read of the word Ayeka, where are you? Did Hashem suddenly lose his X-ray vision? Right? Hashem doesn't know where Adam is? Obviously not. So what does Rashi say? Chniso bidvarim. Hichnizino bidvarim. He says, I want to start a conversation. Hashem understands. That's the way you connect. Hashem understands. Hashem created the human psychology that we're operating by. You ask a question as a means of starting a conversation. And so asking questions in the context of the Seder, ideally it's the child asking the parent, as presented in the Gemara, makes a connection between generations. It helps the child recognize, I am part of this older generation. And that this is a nation that in fact is timeless, because it's children asking questions of parents going all the way back. That, to me, is another reason why we do it in question and answer. If you do it as the parent sits there telling them the Haggadah, leave aside the fact that that's bad pedagogy. That is just going to bore them and put them to sleep. True, but it's not the only point. It's also that then it just becomes, okay, they're the speakers, I'm the audience, you know, I'm taking notes, you know, and fine. Whereas, if the children ask the question of the parent, they build a bond, they build a connection. And that is the continuity of Klal Yisrael. And that's what we're aiming for with Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, is another generation that will recognize that Hashem took us out of Egypt. So I see within this, just to sum this up, the number one, again, the idea of question and answer is not a late innovation. It's in the Chumash. It's there in the initial presentation, Vigadata Levincha, Kiyashalcha Vincha, and so on. We do so many things at the Seder, and again, these are just basics you can add to try to inspire questions from the kids. And it's even a requirement of the Seder, whether everyone has to ask all the questions, or formally say the Manishtana, or whether it's just somebody asks the question and that satisfies. But fundamentally, questions have to be asked in order for the Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, this mitzvah of retelling the Exodus, to be fulfilled. And we said four possible explanations for why. Number one, good pedagogy. Number two, demonstrate freedom. You have the freedom to ask. Number three, to replay the types of questions that brought us to Mitzrayim, but to correct it in the sense that they won't be questions of weak faith. They're actually questions of emunah, questions that build emunah. And then finally, as a robust means of connecting the generations. The last piece that I brought you here, the source number 23, is just a video that I love. I adore this video. And every time I watch it, which I try to do once a year, usually Elul, it makes me cry. And I'm going to cry just talking about it now, and I apologize, but it's beautiful. Anyone ever see the video, The Sparrow? Short, it's like 2.5-3 minutes long. It's a movie in, I want to say it's Greek, but I don't actually know. It's a tiny short film, and the way it works is this: you have a bed.
Spoilers, though.
That's true. Yeah, just go watch it.
No, you're going to get your point. I don't want to ruin your class.
No, you're right. You're right. I shouldn't tell you. You should watch it. You're right. I don't know what to do now. There's a park bench, and there's a father and a son sitting on the park bench. The father looks like he's probably, you know, in his 80s or so, and the son decidedly younger. And they're sitting there on the park bench, and the son is reading his newspaper, and the father is just sort of sitting there. And then a bird lands in a bush, and the father says in this other language, but there are subtitles, so you don't worry. He says, "What is that?" And the son says, "A sparrow." And then, 10 seconds go by, and the father says, "What is that?" And the kid says, "A sparrow." And then another 5 seconds go by. He says, "What is that?" "A sparrow." And the kid is getting more fed up. And you're watching it, you think, okay, so there's a dementia situation. And finally, the kid just like spits out the word, but it's in three syllables in that language, that it's a sparrow. And he's very upset. And the father gets up and walks back towards the house. And the kid says, "Oh, no." That gestures him to sit down. Hey, I'm going to cry. So I'm just going to tell you, watch the video. And you'll see the rest of the video.
No, you can tell us. Everyone will see you. I'm sure they're going to want to know.
Okay,
fine. Give me a tissue then. The father. Yeah. No. So the father comes back with a little red book, and he gives it to the kid. Kid, he's a grown man. Opens it to a certain page and gives it to him, and he says, "Read." And the kid starts to sight read it. He said, "No, out loud." And he reads it out loud, and it's the father's diary, and the diary says, "Today I was playing with my son, and the little sparrow came and landed on the ground, and he asked me, 'What is it?' And I told him, 'A sparrow.' And he asked me, 23 times, and each time I gave him a hug and a kiss, and I told him it was a sparrow." And it was like the love of the father for the child. And of course, now the grown man feels like, whatever. He gives him a hug, and it's this nice, it's this beautiful scene. I'm not telling it as well as the video does. It's beautiful. It reminds you to call your parents. But to me, the reason why I put it on here is that it really carries home the idea of the question as a means of connecting generations. The child who will ask the question, the parent who will answer the question. Unfortunately, there also, it's a reminder that as the parent gets older, the situation may well be reversed. But it's a means of connecting across generations, and that's what we're doing fundamentally at our Siddurim. So watch the video. You'll see. I think you'll appreciate it the way I did. I hope it's still at that link. But if not, Google the sparrow. You'll find it. It's very popular. Thank you very much.
Thank you.